This is the Good Morning Hamilton podcast on 900 CHML.
What if we were to pave a parking lot and put up paradise? That's the story behind one of the controversial issues at City Hall these days. It revolves around a parking lot in Stoney Creek, downtown Stoney Creek, that many businesses say is crucial to allow people to park there to get to their businesses. However, others say, no, we need this space for affordable housing. Because, of course, Hamilton does have an affordable housing problem for sure, like many, many, many slash all cities apparently these days. So a councillor, Ward 12 councillor Craig Kassar, has presented what he believes is a compromise that may be able to move the needle from an 8-8 tie at council. Of course, a tie vote is defeated. So one more vote would be needed to switch to get it to where a housing unit could be built here. I want to bring in Ward 12 councillor Craig Kassar onto the show this morning. Craig, thank you for doing this.
Good morning, Scott.
So the proposal that you came up with, people can read about it. There's 10 items to this one. What would be the thing or things, because some of them are going to be more major, some of them are going to be a little less major. What would be the thing that you believe might, as I say, push that needle and move things where one person might decide, I can live with that and that's going to change my mind?
Well, as you described off the top, there's this conflict between the need for businesses to have parking to thrive and then the need for housing. And there was 57 spots that would be removed to construct two affordable housing units or two buildings. And my proposal has identified the opportunity to add 36 spots immediately on Lake Avenue South, adjacent to the lot in question. And that would be immediate. And then it also directs staff to investigate other opportunities to optimize on-street parking around Stoney Creek, and also to look at potentially underused private lots that could be leased and turned into public parking, which is exactly what's done in Dundas and is successful.
Now, the compromise that you came up with, I think I saw it a couple days ago. I don't know if it was if other councillors saw it before then, but certainly it's been public for at least a couple days now. What kind of response have you got from other councillors? Is there a reason to believe that anybody is thinking of changing their mind at this point?
Yeah, good question. Yes, I've shared that with council more than a week ago when I was working on this. And I've had feedback that that makes sense, that you're addressing some of the concerns that were raised. I've reached out to the Ward 5 councillor, Councillor Francis, have not heard back from him personally. So I can't speak to his opinion. But I know that other councillors have said, yeah, you've addressed the concerns that we've heard. Whether or not they will switch their votes, that remains to be seen.
Why do you think this particular situation, because there are other housing efforts that haven't necessarily come through, why do you think this particular one has become such a flashpoint?
Well, that is also a good question. I mean, this is city-owned property. It is already zoned for this type of housing, so it's natural that it would be used to build housing in a housing crisis. I think part of this has been sides taking a position and not looking at where there's compromise, and that's what I'm trying to do. We need affordable housing, yes, and we need it here. We need it in many other places, and we need all kinds of housing all throughout the spectrum. And you know, then we have the community who wants parking for the businesses, and rightly so. We want businesses to thrive. This is not one or the other. So I don't think there was enough time and effort put into looking at, well, okay, how can we find compromise and problem solve? Because that's what this really is. This is a problem that needs to be solved. It's not one or the other. And that's what I'm bringing. Here are some concerns and here are solutions for them.
You know, it's funny you say this is not one or the other, because I know you've heard the same thing that everyone else has in some social media posts, in some conversations, in some comments. It very clearly has been this is one or the other. This is parking over people. That's the line that's been used. That almost seems like when it gets pushed like that, and I'm not suggesting you did it, but when it gets pushed like that, it just forces everyone to dig in their heels on either side.
And you're right. And it's really unfortunate that, you know, we take positions and boil things down to sound bites. And I understand why people do that. It's human nature, and people are passionate on both sides of this topic and many topics. You know, I want to look at it factually, as I've done, take emotion out of it. What can we do here? There are legitimate concerns from all parties involved. and there are solutions. So that's where I will always focus, is what are the solutions and how can we look at this objectively?
There was another proposal. Now, I mean, clearly, again, housing is needed. There was another proposal that I was reading that Councillor Francis, now I know you said he hasn't spoken to you directly, but regarding the former Lake Avenue School that's not far away from where you're talking about. And apparently the school board it's their land, I think, at this point. They apparently are open to at least a discussion. Are there other options, or is this parking lot really the optimum and utopian place to do this?
Well, as I was saying before, we need housing all across the city, all different types. So this isn't this one project will make or break the housing crisis in our city objectives.
No, obviously.
it is one that we can jump on quickly because we already own it. Own the land and it's already zoned. So we need to be working on these and we need to be working on all other opportunities. So if there are other creative things that can be brought to the table, we should absolutely be doing that too.
One other thing, because we're very short on time and I wish we had more because it's a really interesting topic. One more thing, and that is there have been suggestions that, and I'm sure it captures you in this as well, but that councillors who have strong opinions about other wards maybe shouldn't. What do we say to that when, you know, you represent Ancaster, this is an issue in Stony Creek. If somebody from another ward was coming to talk about an issue that they felt strongly about in Ancaster that wasn't their ward, how do we wrap our heads around that or say what councillors should or shouldn't do in wards that aren't theirs?
Yeah, very, very important topic. I mean, we're a governing body for the entire city of Hamilton. We represent wards. You know, we don't own those wards. If individuals or my colleagues came and said, hey, in Ward 12, we think you're missing something here, you know, I'd want to hear that feedback. I know I'm not perfect. I'm not going to see everything. Everyone has different perspectives. I'd listen to that. And if I didn't act on it or I ignored it, you know, I think my colleagues would have a responsibility to do what's best for the city. So we need to hold each other accountable. We need to listen to each other, and we need to be working together. I wish, you know, there had maybe been more dialogue on this. However, you know, like I said, I put this out more than a week ago and haven't received feedback from the local councillor, which is unfortunate, but we're trying to do the right thing for the city.
That is Ward 12 councillor Craig Kassar. Craig, thank you for doing this.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
It is budget day here in Ontario. And the vow, anyway, from the finance minister, which is our Twitter poll today, is that today's budget is going to make life a little more affordable. That's a quote. Make life a little more affordable. We've asked you on Twitter or X, are you confident this will be the case? Yes, no, or affordable. What is that? Well, let's get into what we think or hope will be there. Simran Singh is Senior Vice President, Senior Policy Analyst, pardon me, Senior Policy Analyst with the Ontario Chamber of Commerce joins us now. Thank you for doing this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
So we've heard that it is going to be making life more affordable. I think probably every finance minister alive has said something like that or similar words before every budget. What could the Ontario government do in this budget that would actually accomplish that?
Happy to answer that question, Scott. I think this year's budget really comes at a critical time as Ontario's business community, you know, continues to struggle with the continued impact of inflation, labor shortages, and just broader economic uncertainty. As per our data, only 13% of Ontario's businesses reported feeling confident about the province's economic prospects, which is at an all-time low. So really what we're really hoping to see in the budget is a principled economic growth strategy of which productivity must be front and center. So we're really hoping that the budget addresses Ontario's productivity gap by not only supporting immediate growth, but also really laying the groundwork for sustainable long-term investments, be it, you know, an educated workforce, long-term infrastructure, or healthy communities. And I think affordability, as you said, has to be an important element of all of those different things.
Well, affordability certainly becomes a big deal because for the business community, if people decide that they don't have any discretionary right. money to spend or even money to spend, that's going to hurt everyone. And it's cyclical because, and if the, you know, so, and the government has said some of the leaks that we've had, and we already know, we had an announcement here in Hamilton last week that there will be money for infrastructure and for housing. What about the businesses though? How would the government in this budget be directly able to help businesses. Is that financial, or is that getting out of the way in some ways to allow businesses to thrive?
I think it's going to be both of those, Scott, because from a cost of living and affordability standpoint, it's an issue that's on the top of mind for businesses. We released a report a couple of months back here at the Chamber, the Ontario Economic Report, in which businesses, I think, overwhelmingly said that the cost of living, cost of inputs, affordability is a top of the mind issue for them. It's really, you know, impacting their ability to attract and retain workers. So whether you talk about housing, which has reached a crisis point, and you know, there's a really important need to incentivize the development of housing options along the continuum, or you talk about, you know, putting more people more money in people's pockets, or a competitive business environment, or really helping small businesses that have been reeling from the continued impact of the pandemic and still are struggling to repay pandemic era loans. I think it has to be a mix of all of those different options.
The carbon tax, as obviously that's federal, I understand, but that's been a big issue of discussion in recent months and weeks and days. And there are polls that show, I think, up to 70% of people in this country right now are saying they shouldn't increase the carbon tax on April the 1st. Now, again, I know that's federal. Mm-hmm. I bring it back to provincial because yesterday or the day before, I think it was yesterday, Doug Ford announced that the gas and fuel tax rate cut will be extended mm-hmm. to the end of the year. That would seem to offset some of the carbon tax increase. Do you see that as a positive thing?
Absolutely. I think from an affordability standpoint, you know, the announcement from the premier about extending the tax cut, like the gas tax cut, to the end of 2024, definitely is something that's going to put more money in people's pockets. No doubt about that. But from a clean energy and a global transition to the green economy, as we're seeing in the province standpoint, I think the government, as I said, should also think about this from the lens of productivity, and that an important element of that from, you know, a climate change perspective has to be accelerating clean energy projects to really advance a province's leadership in the green global economy. So both from, you know, policies like gas tax cuts, which, you know, are hopefully going to be making life more affordable, but also from promoting growth enabling infrastructure like clean energy projects that can also help us ensure long-term sustainability are going to be key, in my opinion.
One more thing. The finance minister yesterday was talking, and here's a quote. It's four words. We're rebuilding the economy, he said. Do you get that sense? Is that how you and the chamber are seeing this? Are they rebuilding the economy?
I think we at the chamber, you know, have had a really productive working relationship with the government, and we have advocated for a host of things. And primarily, they've been focused in four, I think, buckets, as we kind of included in our pre-budget submission. So those included, you know, really empowering Ontario's workforce and addressing labor shortages. And that important element of that was going to be a financially sustainable post-secondary education sector. So you probably know there was this announcement a couple of weeks back by the province to stabilize the funding. It was something that we welcomed, but at the same time, we said that more needed to be done to address the funding shortfall. Similarly, on the infrastructure side of things, we've been very, we've prioritized that the government needs to build and preserve affordable housing along the continuum. We need to build and invest in energy infrastructure. We need to accelerate broadband rollout across the province. So those are things that we will continue to advocate on behalf of, you know, the Ontario businesses. We really welcome the government's funding announcement a couple of days back of close to $1.6 billion in housing infrastructure fund. It's been something that we've been advocating for. But at the same time, as I said, the focus needs to be on growth-enabling sustainable infrastructure investments on a go-forward basis so that we can, you know, ensure a more prosperous economy for all of us.
That is Simran Singh. He is the Senior Policy Analyst for the Ontario Chamber of Commerce. Thank you. We'll be watching today. Thank you for this.
Thank you so much for having me, Scott.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
This afternoon at 4 p.m., we are going to hear from the Ontario government what it is going to present in its budget. So we'll hear their point of view. They're not talking much ahead of time, but we'll hear them at 4 o'clock. We just, before the news break, heard from the Ontario Chamber of Commerce to hear what they would like to see in the budget. What would some of the opposition parties like to see in the budget? Mike Schreiner is the Ontario Green Party leader, joins us now. Mike, thanks for doing this morning.
Hey, my pleasure, Scott. Always happy to be on.
Appreciate you doing this. So I suspect the list may be long that I'm about to ask you about, but what would you like to see in the budget today?
Well, Scott, our top priority is plans to address the housing crisis. That is the number one driver of the affordability crisis people are facing. I mean, we've got rents that are sky high. We got a whole generation of young people wondering if they'll ever be able to own a home. And we also have, you know, a chronic homelessness problem in so many communities across the province. So we're calling on the government to actually start investing in deeply affordable nonprofit, co-op, social, and supportive housing. I mean, not only is $350 million of federal grant money on the table, but more importantly, we have people in our communities who need access to safe, affordable housing. And while we're on the housing file, we need the premier to reverse his opposition to actually building homes that people can afford in the communities they know and love, close to where they spend time with their family and friends and where they work, by legalizing fourplexes, gentle density, and missing middle housing. And of course, we're going to need a climate affordability plan. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about pollution pricing, but we need plans that can help people save money by reducing their energy use, save money by saving energy. We also need to help people be able to afford electrified transportation because it's so much cheaper. And then my final point, Scott, is let's start investing in the services people rely on each and every day, especially healthcare, education, and social services.
Okay, that is a list. Let's go through a few of them, and let's start with the housing because you brought that one up first, and you said that was at the top of the list. This is the endless conundrum. Every single community seems to be struggling with it. I don't know. Well, maybe you know of one that isn't, but I can't recall seeing one that is just moving along tickety-boo here. It seems like such a giant issue with such a massive price tag. Where do you start? If you're the province and you were going to direct some money and you were going to say, okay, it's got to go towards this because this would be the most effective immediate thing, what would that be?
God, it's investing in nonprofit, co-op, social, and permanent housing. The provincial government stopped doing that in 1995, and the housing crisis has been getting worse and worse every year since then. Now we're at a breaking point. 93% of our deeply affordable homes in this province were built before 1995. So the premier just saying no to actually investing in housing is making the crisis worse, and it's, you know, affecting obviously the quality of life for people who are experiencing homelessness, but that filters out and affects all parts of our society, our healthcare system, first responders, local businesses. So we have to invest in that. And then the second key priority is to legalize housing. We need to say yes to things like gentle density, missing middle houses, fourplexes, for example, in existing neighborhoods, so we can quickly build up housing supply in the cheapest way where we already have infrastructure in place.
Should there be, you know, this is an interesting one, and certainly one maybe that more people who currently have housing already will have a point of view on, because we were talking about this yesterday on the show. There is controversy around this, as you know, I'm sure, that a lot of people are saying, yeah, okay, but I don't really want my neighborhood to suddenly have all these extra homes, all these extra people. You know, I bought a house in this neighborhood. How do you find a sweet spot between over-densifying and gently densifying, as you describe?
Yeah, it's a great question, Scott. You know what? I've read one analysis that was done. If only 18% of single-family homes in Ontario within urban core areas became a fourplex, we could build 2 million homes. The provincial goal is 1.5 million. So we just need a fraction of our existing housing supply to become a fourplex. And if you look at a lot of the fourplexes I've toured, many of them are 1, 2, 3-story buildings that you can't even tell in many cases that it is a multiplex. So the premier's fear-mongering around this is just completely out of touch with the scale of the crisis we're facing. I mean, so many people facing sky-high rent, so many young people saying, hey, I'll never be able to own a home. Let's quickly increase housing supply that they can afford in the communities they know and love.
One of the other things, not in the order necessarily you mentioned it, but one of the other things you certainly touched on is something you'd like to see in the budget was increased funding for healthcare. I was reading a tweet that you had put out When was it? Late last night, I guess, about the fact that Ontario has the lowest per capita funding for healthcare, which is true based on Statistics Canada. But even the lowest is $5,300 per person. That's what it works out to. That's a lot of money. When we put more into this, that inevitably would require more taxes on people, would it not?
Well, you know what? We need to not only increase funding for healthcare, but we also need to spend it in smart ways. I mean, part of the problem is the current government is talking about building new buildings, but not actually investing in the people who deliver the care in those buildings. And that's where we need to prioritize our precious healthcare dollars, making sure that everyone has access to a primary healthcare doctor, family doctor, investing in home and community care, because we know that's where most seniors want to age in place, and it is far less expensive than having somebody in a long-term care home. So it's not only about increasing funding, but it's about deploying it in the most strategic ways.
Mike, one more thing. We just have a minute left here. Underlying everything that is going to come up in the budget or that you alluded to or anything else, I would argue, and I think you would agree, the number one thing facing people today is affordability. That's what we hear again and again and again and again. So how do we do these things without adding all kinds of extra taxes that people have to pay? Because it is going to be, there is a trade-off that you have to find the money to do this or just run bigger and bigger debts. How do we do that?
Well, Scott, I agree with you on that. And that's why I'm so focused on addressing the housing crisis, because that is the primary driver of the affordability crisis. And there are things government can do, like legalizing gentle density and missing middle housing, that doesn't cost the Treasury. As a matter of fact, it saves government money. It costs 2.5 times more money to service the kind of sprawl housing that the Premier wants to build than to actually build homes people can afford where we already have existing infrastructure. And then the final point I want to make, Scott, is we spend $7 billion subsidizing electricity prices in Ontario, including those of people with six and seven figure incomes. If we would cap those subsidies and direct them to low and middle income households, that would free up billions of dollars that could be investing in building affordable housing, in improving healthcare and education. So it's a matter of priorities, and this government has misplaced priorities.
That is Mike Schreiner. He is the Ontario Green Party leader. We will, I'm sure, hear more from him after the budget today at 4 o'clock. Mike, really appreciate you taking time to do this today. Thank you.
Hey, anytime, Scott.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
I was reading something the other day about gentle parenting. Some people call it peaceful parenting, and there's a variety of different words or versions of a similar theme. The idea being that it's a different way, I guess, than traditionally parents dealt with or raised their children. It is more about mutual respect as opposed to being an authority figure. And I hope I'm explaining this right. It's more about talking through issues rather than punishment when a child misbehaves. Some people have said this is the new, better way of parenting. Others have said gentle parenting is just simply not parenting at all. Let me bring in Sarah Rosensweet. She is a certified peaceful parenting coach. She's a speaker, an educator, and a host of the top-rated parenting podcast, The Peaceful Parenting Podcast. She joins us now. Sarah, how are you this morning?
Good morning.
Thank you. I had to read that slowly. I was going to get that's a lot of P's in there. What do you say right off the bat to people who say, look, the idea, kids need boundaries, kids need authority figures, kids need not to be beaten. I'm not suggesting that. I'm not even talking about that, but need strong parenting rather than peaceful or gentle parenting. What do you say to those people?
Oh, I think if they think that it's not strong parenting, then they don't understand what it is.
Okay, so what is it then? Because it sounds more like, as I read it and I understand it, and you tell me where I've got this wrong, it sounds a lot more like being your child's friend than being your parent sometimes. At least that's how it's interpreted, I think.
Well, that's funny that you say that. I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with being your child's friend, and it still doesn't mean that you have to, that your child is in charge. But, you know, friendship is based on mutual respect and understanding and treating each other treating each other well. So I'm not sure if that's a helpful way to think about it. you know, what we often say is that, well, there are three, I could give you the three main ideas.
Please,
of,
yes.
Of peaceful parenting. The first big idea is focus on parental self-regulation, which doesn't mean that you never get upset or frustrated, but that when you do, you try to manage your emotions so that you're not taking it out on your child. The second big idea is an emphasis on connection and the relationship. That's really the only true influence we have over another person if we don't want to use power and control. And then the third big idea, which I think people forget about, is kind, firm limits without punishment. So there's not, the child is not in charge in peaceful parenting. I think some of the misunderstandings on social media come from this idea that, you know, conventional parenting is that the needs and preferences of the parent are always centered, right? We're not flipping that on its head and now saying that the needs and preferences of the child are always centered. We're talking about teamwork. We try to work together so that we can, so that everybody gets a little bit of what they want.
The without punishment is a phrase, and again, there are levels of punishment, and I think we all understand that, and there's everything from being abusive to, you know, have a timeout or whatever. Without punishment, what does that mean? Because surely at some point when your kid disobeys, I mean, I like to think that our kids were pretty good, but there were times when, you know, they weren't. What do you do when you try to correct a child who's misbehaving?
Well, think about if you make a mistake at work. Do you need your boss to take you aside and say, hey, listen, that report was due yesterday. It didn't get done. What's going on? How can we make sure this doesn't happen again? Do you need extra support? You know, did you not have time? Do you have, you know, what's going on here? Or do you need your boss to take you in front of everybody, yell at you, tell you you have to stay late and dock your pay? Like, which one do you think would respond to better in the workplace?
I would say certainly the first one, unless this was now the third or fourth or fifth time that I hadn't got a report done on time, and then I think the second one might be warranted.
Yeah, fair enough. But what we find is that kids do respond to the first.
Okay. So
I mean, I'll tell you my kids are 16, 19, and 23. My 19 and 23-year-old are launched, like super independent, successful at University of Toronto, and none of them have ever once been punished.
In meaning what? In any way? Not a timeout? Corrected, right? Corrected.
Corrected. That's totally different than punishment,
yeah.
Though.
Okay,
but punishment is meant to make somebody feel bad, right? Like, so there are times, this is what we like to differentiate between limits and punishment. So a limit might be like, okay, say your kid is, you're in the living room, your kid's like banging their toy truck on the table.
Been there.
And you say, hey, cut it out, that's going to hurt the table. They don't stop. You might have to take the truck away. But the way you do it, it can be either a limit or it can be punishment. So if you do it as a limit, you're like, you know what? I'm going to have to hold on to that truck. You're not listening. Let's do something else, right? They learn, hey, I shouldn't bang this truck on the table or my truck is going to get taken away. But you're not doing it in a way to make them feel bad and shame them, right? So the other way you could do it is like, I told you three times to stop doing that. Now I'm going to take your truck away and you're not getting it back till tomorrow, right? Totally different scenario. So you want to look at, you know, is this a health and safety concern? And in this case, I would say yes, like the, you know, safety of the table not getting damaged. Is it hurting people or property? Yes. So you want to do something. You want to step in and scaffold that child. And in this case, it might mean taking the truck away and putting it somewhere else, distracting the child, moving on to something else. And that your tone is, you know, kind and respectful, and your intent is to prevent the table from getting hurt, not to make the child feel shame.
What happens when someone who is a child who is raised with this ends up going to school and, say, gets a detention or something where it is punishment? Is it difficult for them to grasp that concept of what's happened?
No, because kids understand that there are different rules in different places and different expectations. So you can go to grandma's house and you know you should never jump on the couch. It might be allowed at your house, but you can't jump on the couch at grandma's house. Kids can get that. I think my only one of my children to ever get detention was probably my middle child. I think he got a detention in middle school. And he didn't come home and say, that's not fair. He knew, you know, he'd broken the rules at school. I think he was skateboarding in the yard when there was not skateboarding allowed in the yard, showing someone he could do an ollie or something like that. And he knew that he'd broken a rule at school and that there were different expectations and different consequences at school than there might be at home.
Look, we could talk about this for hours because it is nothing is more discussable than parenting styles. I remember the very first days that we came home and my wife and a friend mentioned about whether the baby should sleep in the bed or in the cot. And my goodness, from day one, it was already a debate. So people can read more about this if they want. Peacefulparent.com is a website that will talk about this as well. Also, the Peaceful Parenting Podcast with Sarah Rosensweet, who we've just been chatting with. Sarah, thank you for talking about this today.
You are so welcome. Have a great day.
You as well.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton Podcast from 900 CHML.
Taxes are going up, and taxes are going up for a reason. They go up for programs, but they also go up because government is expensive. We have large government in this province, in this country. We have a lot of people working for government. And apparently, that number, well, not even apparently, I think we know that that number grows. The question is, we know it's growing. How much is it growing? Well, my next guest, I think, can answer that question. He is Alex Whalen. He's the Associate Director for Atlantic Canada of the Prosperity Initiative for the Fraser Institute. Joins us now. Alex, how are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I appreciate you doing this. I know you've just come out with a new look at how much government has increased over the last number of years, and I've just seen the numbers here, some of them province by province, and what's the nice way of saying it? It's up. Quite simply, it's up. How much?
So in a province like Ontario, government spending as a share of GDP is up over 40% now. So that means that over 40% of the provincial economy is simply government spending at the federal, provincial, and municipal levels. In Ontario, that's up 4.3 percentage points since 2007. It is up in most provinces across Canada, and we're trying to draw a bit of attention to that and also discuss the unfortunate effects of a large and growing government sector.
Okay, I am not an economist, and I'm not going to pretend to be one, but at 40% of the GDP, 40% of the economy just being government spending, that doesn't on its face sound entirely healthy, is it?
No, it's certainly a challenge for a country like Canada. There are a number of unfortunate outcomes that stem from a large government sector. The economic research is quite clear that once you go beyond about 26 to 30% of the economy being occupied by government, we start to see reduced rates of economic growth. You see a weakened private sector because the government competes with the private sector for investment and for labor and other scarce resources. And for the average person, that means a lower standard of living. And that's quite concerning, given that basically every province in Canada, except for one, is above that optimal range. And some provinces are well above that optimal range. The other thing I would mention as well, just quickly, is that while government represents 40% of the economy in Ontario in terms of direct spending, that actually underestimates just how large the government footprint is, because that's not even accounting for things like regulation.
Right. And I was just looking as we're talking here, because McDonnell Laurier Institute has looked at something similar not that long ago, and its numbers were kind of roughly similar to where you were, but they say with regulation, with tax expenditures and price regulation, the number across the province, across the country now, not just Ontario, goes up to 64% of GDP for government. That's staggeringly high. Two-thirds of our economy is essentially government.
Exactly. And that's been growing over time. And when you significantly exceed the estimates of the optimal size of government, I think for the average person, it's really important to understand that that diminishes economic growth, and therefore that will diminish our standards of living. So the size of government is a big problem in Canada right now.
I'm not an anarchist. I do believe we need a government, and I think we should have a government. So you mentioned optimal size of government. What is the optimal size?
I think that's a great point. So obviously, I'm not an anarchist either. And what the research shows us on this is that when government is a relatively small share of the economy, What government tends to do is very important. So basic infrastructure and things like that. Once you get up to about 26 to 30% of the economy, that's what the research says is the optimal level for encouraging economic growth. Now, you could make judgments about whether that's a major priority or not. I think it is. But once you get beyond that 26 to 30% range, economic growth starts to be harmed by the overly burdensome size of government.
And I don't remember the numbers right now, but I know that a while back I saw... maybe it was from some other organization, but I mean, the amount of growth that there's been in the federal government just during the time of COVID and since, I mean, it's been a large expansion. This is not something that is stagnant or grew a while back and has stayed still. We've been seeing bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger government, correct?
Absolutely, at the federal level and at most provincial levels as well. So if you look at a province like Ontario, you have a federal government that has dramatically increased in size, but you also have a provincial government that has been running deficits, increasing spending and increasing employment. In a province like Ontario, 1 in 5 people work directly for the government. That's before you even take into account things like contractors or people that are receiving outsourcing from the government. So certainly a large and growing concern.
We know that over years, I don't want to be too general here, but the Atlantic provinces have had some unique challenges in this country. And I wonder, as I look at the numbers in PEI, 58.3%. of government spending as a percentage of GDP, Nova Scotia 63, New Brunswick 57.6. Is it that high because they need help and so government is spending there, or is it the some of the challenges the Atlantic province is facing because it's so high? Which way does it go?
Well, as you mentioned off the top, I am based in Halifax, so I look at this issue closely, and I think that this region has been harmed by a large government sector. That's entirely consistent with what the research would say. As you mentioned, you look at a province like Nova Scotia, we're up over 60% of the economy is dominated by government. We see it all the time. Government competes with the private sector when it's that large. So investment dollars are scarce, talent is scarce, labor markets are tight. And so we often see government competing with the private sector, and that makes for a weakened private sector, weakened investment and weakened economic growth. So I think the Atlantic provinces have certainly been harmed by a large government footprint. But it is important to note that while the Atlantic provinces are, you know, somewhat outliers in Canada, every province other than Alberta is well above the optimal range.
We have 30 seconds only, so you got to be really quick on this one, Alex. But as I look at these numbers, does this suggest then that if Pierre Poilievre wins the next election, which it looks the polls say he will, if he were to do what he says and start cutting some of the government, is this going to just ravage certain parts of the country then? It's almost locked in that you can't without destroying the economy.
I think any party that implements spending control will see the benefits over the long run. There may be short-term costs, but the research is clear that in the long run, there will be benefits.
Alex Whalen, the Associate Director for Atlantic Canada Prosperity Initiative with the Fraser Institute. Alex, I really appreciate taking time today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast from 900 CHML.
Yesterday, I don't know if you tuned in to watch Shohei Ohtani, the biggest star in baseball, one of the biggest stars in world sports, period, when you consider his fan base over in Asia and around the world. He spoke in a press conference. It wasn't really a press conference because they didn't take any questions. He had a statement through his translator because he has found himself caught up in a bit of a gambling scandal that he says in this statement had nothing to do with him. His former interpreter stole money from him, paid a bookie, was involved in gambling, had a gambling addiction, lied, did all kinds of other stuff. But Shohei, not me, nothing to do with me. Really, in this statement, left very little wiggle room. I mean, if he was not telling the absolute truth, he left himself very little wiggle room because he was adamant that this was not him any way, shape, or form. I want to bring in Moshe Launder, who is a senior economics lecturer at Concordia University. Moshe, how are you this morning?
Good morning.
This, I don't know if you watched, I'm assuming you did yesterday. I'll say this, I don't know where the truth is in this. I thought, if nothing else, Shohei was compelling. He came across as plausible. There were questions still that I still have, but he came across, I thought, as plausible.
Yeah, plausibility is good, believable, but I still don't think that that's the right story that we heard. It changed too quickly in the beginning, and even this version that we heard yesterday doesn't quite match with the version that we heard when this news broke last week. And of course, he understands what's at stake if he's in any way connected to gambling. So, I wonder if there's an element here of PR, and I wonder if there's an element of Major League Baseball also trying to say, look, we don't want to have to suspend you, so let's get something out there that allows us to all move forward.
Well, yeah, so to your point, and for those who have not been following the story absolutely closely, part of the challenge of the statement yesterday, while as a why he presented very well, you're absolutely right that there are still a lot of questions. And yes, his story in the first few hours changed a number of times and seemed to change again. It has been a bit of a moving target, which is not going to help when people try to figure out what exactly went on.
Right. And, even now, when we look back at the contract that he signed in the offseason, he was praised for his brilliance of getting a $700 million contract that was supposed to be over 10 years. So that should have been $70 million a year. Instead, news starts to come out that it's only $2 million a year for 10 years, and the other $680 million is deferred to years 11 to 20, when allegedly he'll have retired by then. But now you start looking at it and wondering, did he know that maybe there was a suspension coming? Did he know that he was in trouble? And so almost the Deshaun Watson situation in football, where you have this money that's backloaded, knowing that you're going to be in trouble up front, and so the amount of money that you're out is small. Did he know that his interpreter was tied up in gambling? And so by deferring the money to 10 years when he's back in Japan and he doesn't need an interpreter, he'll be able to enjoy the money rather than having to use that money to bail out his interpreter. I mean, there's so many recklessly speculative things that you could do, but they now start to come back into question of, was that genius on his part to help his team win, or was that to cover up something that he knew was going to come out at some point?
Well, and I don't know about you. I don't know how they pay at Concordia. I don't have $60 or $70 million in my bank account right now, but I do find the question, the idea that his interpreter of all people, I guess according to his story, was just able to draft money orders or something and send them to the bookie out of his bank account, because certainly the interpreter didn't have $5 or $6 million in his account. And the money, the whole thing started because there were checks or money orders that were in Shohei's name. I don't, again, Moshe, I don't know about you. I would like to think that I would notice if $5 million had gone missing suddenly from my bank.
Yeah, and the checks that he was signing, or the money that he was transferring, checks, I sound so old. He was transferring $500,000 at a time. And so when you transfer that much money, pretty much any conventional bank is going to have a lot of security levels in place. It doesn't matter whether he's earning $60 million a year, or $600,000 or $60,000 a year. You can't transfer that much money from a conventional bank without a lot of verification. And so there too, it's impossible for him to say, I didn't know. And it's not the type of relationship I would assume that he has with an interpreter, even though they are very close, allegedly, that you would just say, hey, bud, I need $500,000. No problem. Let me just transfer it over. No questions asked.
Yeah, imagine, I mean, if you or I or anyone listening goes even, it gets an unusual payment that comes out of our credit card, we will often get a call or a text or an email or something saying, did you do this? Many people listening have had that experience. I can't imagine $500,000 going in the bank just saying, oh, okay, Bob is taking money out of Shohei's account. Obviously. These are, and there may be entirely innocent explanations for these. They just weren't offered yesterday, and they still are out there. One more thing. You mentioned about suspension. I don't think we're anywhere close to that right now, but let's say, hypothetical, because we're not anywhere close to there yet, let's say Major League Baseball found something. This guy is Major League Baseball's golden goose right now around the world. Do you believe Major League Baseball would ever do anything, or would this simply become more of, we're just going to pile this on the interpreter and we just cannot suspend this guy?
Yeah, if he's found linked to gambling, they're going to have to finally change the golden rule in baseball that you cannot gamble. This is the Pete Rose, Shoeless Joe Jackson situation. But the difference there was that Shoeless Joe was a century ago and Pete Rose was a manager at the time and he wasn't a good manager. You know, now that baseball's involved with gambling, if they ban him for life, there's going to be such blowback. There's going to be so many TVs that turn off. There's just no way they're going to have to do that. So I think it's likely that they're going to change the rule. They'll take disciplinary action against him. They might suspend him for a year. He's repairing an elbow anyway. But I just don't see that he's going to get the Pete Rose treatment here. They can't afford it, especially when they're trying to build the game globally, especially when they start the season in Asia, in part to try and market him to the Korean audience with Japan just next door.
Yeah, I maybe I'm just too cynical. I just can't see baseball doing that. I think they will find a way to not, even if that were to happen. And again, that's way down the road because all we had was a press conference and there's an investigation apparently still going on, but who knows? It is certainly it's an interesting one that we didn't expect. This is the way the Shohei Ohtani LA Dodgers era was going to begin. Moshe Launder, Senior Economics Lecturer at Concordia University, thank you for doing this.
Anytime.
Thanks for listening to the Good Morning Hamilton podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday mornings from 5:30 to 9 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
The Good Morning Hamilton podcast is available on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and wherever you get your favorite podcast. I'm Rick Samprin. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure you rate and review.